Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
A good night's sleep is going extinct. The rise of tech and stress in the modern world is keeping people awake. Some are even turning to cat memes to get them through the night. IKEA is here to help with everything you need to build up your rest reserves. Stylish bedding, supportive mattresses, and unique bed frames. So you can stop cat memeing and start cat napping. See what I did there? Discover new ways to save your sleep today.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Joe Lynham, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 19th of July, these are our main stories. The Dutch Supreme Court has ruled that the Netherlands was partially responsible for the death of 350 Muslim men in their care in Srebrenica in 1995. Saudi Arabia has reminded people to respect Islamic law after a number of US pop stars, including Janet Jackson, have performed in Jeddah. And
she said, yes, absolutely. She said, without question, I distance myself decisively from his comments and feel solidarity with the attacked women.
The German Chancellor Angela Merkel joins in the criticism of Donald Trump's comments about four US congresswomen. Also in this podcast, the former South African President Jacob Zuma has withdrawn his threat to stop giving evidence to an inquiry into government corruption. And
they are particularly invasive, and so there's a need to try and keep on top of them.
The striking-looking fish that's colonising the Mediterranean. We find out why it's a threat and what can be done about it. But first, it was one of the single worst acts of barbarity in the civil war in the former Yugoslavia, almost a quarter of a century ago, when 8,000 Muslim men and boys were murdered by Bosnian Serb troops in the town of Srebrenica. Of those killed, 350 were in the direct care of lightly armed Dutch UN peacekeeping troops. The failure of the Dutch troops to protect the Bosnian Muslims in July 1995 has traumatised Dutch politics ever since. A couple of hours before we recorded this podcast, the highest court in the Netherlands ruled that the Dutch state was indeed partially liable for the deaths of the 350. One of the women from the group, Mothers from Srebrenica, Kada Hotic, said that they were very angry about the verdict, which she said didn't go far enough.
This is a big humiliation. Dutch politics and the commanders of the Dutch military are responsible. This is how they try to humiliate us. 56 members of my extended family were killed, but we are here and we will fight for justice. Our daughters are having children, and Muslims will never be expelled from Europe. Muslims are civilized, unlike this court.
Anna Holligan, our correspondent in The Hague, told me more about the ruling and about the massacre in 1995.
Traumatized Dutch politicians, but also the soldiers who served on that day. I've just been speaking to one of them. He was 19 years old at the time, and he told me that they had no choice, that they organized this evacuation, which turned into a deportation, which ended in the executions. Ultimately, 8,000 Muslim men and boys were slaughtered by Bosnian Serb forces. So Radko Mladic's men had rampaged through the country. The Muslim refugees had sought refuge at this UN compound, expected to be protected in what was a designated UN safe zone. But the Dutch soldiers were 350 in total, facing thousands of Bosnian Serbs. This young soldier at the time just told me that they only had 100 rounds each. They tried to fend them off, but in the end they couldn't. So they helped to organize the evacuation by putting the refugees into groups. There were thousands of people here at this UN compound in the summer of July 1995 it was. They organized them into groups and then they funneled them out of the compound. And as that happened, the Bosnian Serb forces picked out the men, separated them from the women and children and took them away to be executed. This case in particular, so we're outside the Supreme Court in the Netherlands, the highest court. This case in particular relates to the fate of 350 Muslim men who were hiding inside the compound. So not just within the periphery but actually inside the building. And the Dutch soldiers didn't give them a choice, the judges said, to stay or leave. And in forcing them out, it meant that the Dutch soldiers knew that they would probably be executed and that they should have at least given them a choice whether to stay or go. And in failing to give them a choice, they were 10% liable, the court found, because if they'd have been allowed to stay, there was a 10% chance that they may have survived. But given the ferocity at which the Bosnian Serbs were sweeping through the country, intent in carving out this ethnically pure land free of Muslims, the judges couldn't say for sure whether or not they would have survived had they been allowed to stay. I've also been speaking to a couple of the mothers who've made this their life mission to pursue justice on behalf of the thousands of other survivors. Munira Subasic is here now. She lost her son and her husband in the Srebrenica massacre. And she said, 10% is a joke. I only got 3% of my son's body back. What does 10% mean to me? So they plan to take this even further to seek justice at another court, because as far as they're concerned, they haven't found it here in The Hague today.
That's Anna Holligan speaking to me from The Hague. The US pop star Janet Jackson has been performing to thousands of adoring fans. Nothing new there, but it was far from a normal concert. That's because it was in the heart of Saudi Arabia, where the hardline Islamic Kingdom is hosting the Jeddah World Fest, the most high-profile music event based in the country. Fellow US musicians Chris Brown and 50 Cent also played. The rapper Nicki Minaj, initially booked in for the show, pulled out because of what she described as human rights concerns. I asked our Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher, how did these artists end up playing in Saudi Arabia, which is an absolute and highly conservative monarchy?
What's become a big thing in Saudi Arabia, strangely enough, in the past couple of years, I mean, obviously the image is of this very austere, very puritanical country where any kind of entertainment was essentially outlawed. Imagine Western pop stars coming. Janet Jackson, think of videos that she's been in. Look at the way that Saudi women are dressed. You'd think this doesn't fit together. Now, she was dressed in a more conservative way than she usually is. She was mostly covered, although
there were no malfunctions, wardrobe or otherwise.
But they hadn't looked at that. That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. Her male dancers actually displayed a lot more skin than her female dancers. I don't know if that's really allowed. But I think it was Nicki Minaj was the act that really got people's juices going in Saudi Arabia, you know, on both sides. A lot of people saying, this is great, this is fantastic, you know, this is the kind of person we never expected to come. But the hardliners really thinking this is going too far. I mean, she, you know, is at the forefront of, you know, very provocative, very highly sexualized act. Now, she pulled out, citing human rights concerns. But it is a sign of how things in Saudi Arabia are changing. Just very quickly, the Entertainment Authority has been criticized in the past couple of days by the Shura Council, a big legislative body in Saudi Arabia, saying it's going a bit too far.
But does this mean now that Saudi Arabia is inching towards a more liberal outlook towards Western culture? Is that too soon?
It's embracing it in terms of giving its young population much greater leeway and also trying to build an economic system that will give them jobs, that will give them a sense of belonging to the country, that will bring money and keep it in the country. So there's all sorts of entertainment initiatives going on. These are ones that hit the headlines. But there is pushback. The Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, his advisors are saying, you know, he's fighting against the very traditional, very hardline clerics. But I have to say, most of them are either in prison or keeping very quiet.
Sebastian Usher there. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been giving a press conference in Berlin. She brushed aside questions about her health after she was seen visibly shaking in public in recent weeks. There have also been questions about President Trump's controversial comments about the four US congresswomen and whether she stood with the women of colour. Our Europe correspondent Damian Grammaticus was listening.
She was asked that a number of other leaders had already addressed Mr. Trump's comments and expressed support for those four Democratic congresswomen. Remember, he had said he described them as hate-filled extremists and told them to go home to their own countries. Mrs. Merkel asked about it and whether she would follow suit. She said, yes, absolutely. She said, without question, I distance myself decisively from his comments and feel solidarity with the attacked women. And then she went on to say that in her view, what made America great or strong, she said, was the contribution made by people of different backgrounds and different nationalities. So Mrs. Merkel, who has in the past not been hesitant to criticise Mr. Trump, again laying out very clearly her position.
Damien Grammaticus. The Australian government agency that manages the Great Barrier Reef has warned that only the strongest and fastest possible action would save it from the effects of climate change. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia's greenhouse gas emissions have increased in the last 4 years. The government, a keen supporter of the coal industry, has yet to adopt reduction targets agreed to under the Paris climate deal. That could spell disaster for the Great Barrier Reef, according to the federal agency that oversees the world's largest coral system. It's warned that an urgent cut in carbon pollution both nationally and globally was needed to protect the future of the reef.
Phil Mercer there reporting from Sydney. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. Every weekend you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's The World This Week, and Carolyn Wyatt joins me now to tell me what's in the latest edition.
We'll look at the row over racism in the US, sparked by Donald Trump this week after he called on four US Democratic congresswomen to go home and failed to stop a crowd chanting "send her back." We'll ask what economic growth of a mere 6% means for China after its golden years of higher growth. And we'll hear of the hopes and fears in Sudan, where the opposition and the military this week reached a power-sharing deal after months of turmoil. We'll also be looking up at the stars and the race for dominance in space, and at why footballers are no longer worth their weight in gold.
Thanks, Caroline. And that's all in The World This Week, broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays and available to download from our website, bbc.co.uk/programmes. And still to come in this edition of our own podcast,
a worryingly high number of people question what I would consider to be one of our most sort of technologically and in fact sort of spiritually significant achievements.
On the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landings, a new musical project tries to challenge the notion that the mission never actually took place. The former South African President Jacob Zuma has withdrawn his threat to stop giving evidence to an inquiry into government corruption. Mr. Zuma's lawyer had said this refusal to cooperate was because his client had faced relentless cross-examination. But shortly before we came into the studio, the head of the inquiry announced that Jacob Zuma would continue to give evidence. So what's going on? A question I put to our Southern Africa correspondent, Andrew Harding.
The issue was that Jacob Zuma felt exposed on the witness stand to some pretty pointed, direct, specific questions. And basically wanted out. He has come up with this deal now. We don't know the full details, but it looks like the lawyers for the Commission of Inquiry and Mr. Zuma's lawyers will exchange documents and look at the specific issues, the allegations made by numerous former cabinet ministers and civil servants against Mr. Zuma. And he will have a chance in writing to respond to some of those allegations rather than on the stand under oath. And that subsequent to that, there may be further follow-up testimony required from the president. But in a sense, it feels like it's being kicked into touch a little.
Now, tell us a little bit more about this inquiry. It's not a full kind of judicial process, but it is judge-led.
It's judge-led. Mr. Zuma and other witnesses have been under oath, and it's looking into specifically this idea of state capture, which basically focuses on the allegation that Mr. Zuma and his friends, the very wealthy Gupta family, conspired to essentially hand over control of cabinet, hand over control of key lucrative government contracts at state enterprises to the Gupta family, to the Zumas and his family. So very serious allegations that have been made under oath, but it is not a court of law. The suspicion or the expectation is that at some point in the future, the prosecuting authority might act on some of the information either from this inquiry or from leaked emails or other testimony and bring more charges against Mr. Zuma, a man who's already facing trial on earlier corruption allegations.
And would he be described as a convincing witness thus far?
Well, he spent the first day essentially giving a political speech, saying that he was the victim of a vast, decades-long international conspiracy, something that I think a lot of people found outrageous and so shadowy as to be unprovable, and, of course, far from the focus of this inquiry. Since then, a lot of denials.
Andrew Harding there. Over the past week or so, there's been a great deal written and said about the 50th anniversary of the moon landings. But how do you convey the mood and the excitement of that moment to a generation who've grown up with it just being part of history? One attempt to do exactly that will be taking place at this year's Proms, the annual series of classical music concerts, which starts in London today. The Race for Space by the UK-based band Public Service Broadcasting uses rock music, an orchestra, film and snippets from the sound archive, and it aims to reach an audience that has its doubts about whether the mission to the moon ever took place. David Sillitoe has been talking to the project's creator.
The eyes of the world now look into space.
My name is Jay Woolgus Esquire, and I am in a band, Public Service Broadcasting.
To the moon and to the planets beyond.
We kind of plundered the archives.
And we have vowed that we shall not see it governed by a hostile flag of conquest.
Put loads of NASA sound clips alongside loads of Russian sound clips that we got, and wrote a kind of record around that, trying to sort of retell these stories with a degree of imagination and trying to recapture some of the excitement of the period.
We're off to a good start. Play it cool.
Why?
Why? That is a very good question. There's a personal interest in the story, there's a personal interest in the history, and I have to say a personal interest in kind of fighting against some of the lazy cynicism that's kind of prevalent, especially in my generation and younger, where a lot of people are all too eager to kind of swallow the line that none of this ever happened. I think that's a terribly lazy and cynical approach to take, and I wanted to push back against that.
Soviet citizen, Major Gagarin Yuri Alekseyevich.
A lot of people? Well, there is evidence. He's right. In April, YouGov released a poll. Around 20% of people in their 20s and early 30s think the moon landings were definitely, or probably, staged.
A worryingly high number of people question what I would consider to be one of our most sort of technologically and in fact sort of spiritually significant achievements as a species.
And now a new breakthrough in space conquests.
It's not just questioned, it's actually actively denied. And I think one of the things that's been great about this record and the way it's been received has been getting in front of crowds and especially the younger generation, seeing the way that they react to it, seeing the excitement that a song like Go can kind of generate when you play it in that kind of environment.
Okay, I'll fly controllers. I'm going around the horn. Okay, retro. Go. Final. Go. Guide. Go. Control.
Jay Woolgus Esquire of the band Public Service Broadcasting, ending that report by David Sillitoe. You wouldn't normally expect to find a tiger resting on your bed, but one man in the flood-ravaged state of Assam in northern India found himself confronted with this rather unusual sight in his house. The tiger had apparently escaped the flooded Kaziranga National Park and was looking for some dry land. Our South Asia regional editor, Ambasaran Etharajan, has the details.
The Kaziranga Wildlife Park is home to one-horned rhinos and tigers and elephants. And this whole state has been ravaged by floodwaters because the Brahmaputra burst its banks and then nearly 90% of this wildlife park was flooded and a number of animals were also killed. And the photographs on our website and different agencies will show you how on a small patch of land, 10 or 15 rhinos resting, whereas they were all surrounded by water. So this particular tiger, a female tiger, it escaped from the floods. It crossed a national highway. And because of this traffic and sound, it was, you know, trying to find a quiet
sanctuary.
Place. Yes, sanctuary. It was finding sanctuary, yeah. And when it walked into this tin roof shed, because the house and the shop, they were next to each other, the owner of the house and others, they just ran out of the house in the morning. But it just went inside and rested on the bed. And when the wildlife officials were informed, they came in. So they didn't want to disturb the tiger because it came in the morning, around 7 in the morning. And they were waiting for sunset so that it can be guided back into the forest. And one of the wildlife officials said it had a nice nap on the bed for the whole day.
But it wasn't tranquilized or anything. It was just kind of guided out of the house.
Yeah, when they opened the door and then they were like chasing it and then it was properly guided and then it went back into the forest.
And Barasan Etharajan, our South Asia regional editor. Lionfish are stunning to look at with their big mane of poisonous spines and their bright orange stripes. But they're also a big problem in some parts of the world where they've migrated due to climate change. An effort to eliminate them from the Mediterranean has begun by promoting them as food. Dr. Sian Rees, a senior research fellow at the University of Plymouth in southwest England, told Dan Damon about this, and she began by describing her last encounter with the lionfish.
My most recent encounter with the lionfish was when I visited Cyprus to visit our project partners in October last year, and we decided to have our first cook of lionfish to see what they would be like deep fried alongside some other marine invasive species. That was our first test of trying to begin the campaign for creating a market for lionfish as a food.
What's wrong with them? They're very beautiful.
They are very beautiful, but they don't belong in the Mediterranean. They're following the warming waters through the Suez Canal. And as they have no natural predators and they are incredibly good at reproducing and they're incredibly good predators, they tend to take over the system as well as eating lots of smaller fish. And those smaller fish are things that we also like to eat. And also those sort of fish that maintain our reefs and our kelp forests. So they are particularly invasive. And so there's a need to try and keep on top of them.
It's a funny idea to eat your way through an invasive species, but that's not going to work, is it?
The thing that we have to get used to is as our climate changes and there's various pressures on the system, is that we'll never get rid of lionfish completely. Now they've come through into the Mediterranean. Cyprus is the sort of first port of call, really, before they eventually start to spread through the Mediterranean. So we'll never get rid of them completely. But what we can do is prevent them from taking over the system and becoming the dominant species by trying to do things such as removal events, creating a market for food for them, and also potentially setting up early surveillance systems. So as they do spread through the Med to other countries, potentially you can have an early warning signal and attempt some removal events at that stage.
Where they are naturally occurring, are there predators there?
Well, there always have been predators in the past. I mean, bigger species such as sharks will attempt to eat lionfish. But within our Mediterranean system and also in parts of the Caribbean where these species have really taken hold in some places, we don't have the larger predators anymore to keep these populations in check.
If you're swimming in the Med and you see one of these coming towards you, what would you do? Run away?
They're actually very slow and quite sedate, and they sort of just float within the water, and they do look absolutely beautiful.
Would they sting you?
They would sting you if you came too close to them, but they don't deliberately attack, so to speak. It's a defence mechanism that they have. But when you take these fish to market, the spines are very, very easily removed, and so then it makes the fish safe to eat.
What do they taste like?
They're very high in the good omegas. They're very high in protein and they're a white meat. They're not particularly strong. So it's pretty much like the other sort of fish flavours that we're used to, the sort of the light white meat.
Do you think the British will be eating lionfish and chips?
Potentially. We have fished our seas to such an extent that we have to start to consider alternative options of what maybe we would like to eat in the future. And something like lionfish would be a great alternative.
Dr. Sian Rees there from the University of Plymouth speaking to Dan Damon. Now, researchers in the US say that listening to relaxing music could be just as good as medication at calming patients' nerves before surgery. They compared the effects of a specially composed piece of music to a drug often given to anxious patients before an anaesthetic. Philippa Roxby reports.
In the trial of 150 patients, half were given noise-cancelling headphones and played a song specifically designed to reduce anxiety, blood pressure and heart rate. Weightless by the UK band Marconi Union. The other half was given a drug which helps to cause drowsiness and decrease anxiety. Researchers from the University of Pennsylvania found that in both groups, patient anxiety reduced by the same amount. They believe that music medicine could be a good alternative to drugs, which can have side effects and require close monitoring by doctors. In contrast, they say music is harmless and inexpensive. But there were downsides. Patients said they would have preferred to choose their own music, and doctors said communication with patients was harder because they were wearing headphones.
Philippa Roxby reporting. And now we come to the part of our podcast when we tell you about the few less reported stories of the week from around the world. With me in the studio is Martin Morgan from the BBC Monitoring team, which follows local news in many languages. To start off, Martin, penguins have been helping themselves at a sushi bar in New Zealand. How did that come about?
Well, we don't normally think of New Zealand and penguins in the same breath, do we? But it's not actually that far from Antarctica. And the city of Wellington has a big colony of what are called blue penguins. These are the smallest species of penguin, and they're usually happy just to stay in the harbour. But this week, police have been called out to deal with what they've referred to as grumpy little penguins wandering around the streets. And one pair in particular has taken a liking to a sushi bar near the railway station.
I'm guessing it's because of the fish in the sushi bar.
Yes, it's not just the fish, actually. It's the breeding season. So this couple settled on the bar because it's also warm and it's safe from the sort of predators that could disturb their nest and harm their chicks. Now, the City Conservation Department told the bar owner to be prepared for more visits by these, non-paying guests, you could say, because blue penguins are very persistent. And once they've made a cozy nest somewhere, they will keep coming back to it.
Now, women who sell fruit and vegetables in the markets in Uzbekistan are up in arms about the head of the country's Women's Committee, who's had some harsh words for them. What's it all about?
Well, the committee's meant to promote women's rights, but its new head, she's called Elmira Bositkhonova, has said that women working in the farmers' markets lack spirituality and education, which everybody in the country has taken to mean that she thinks they're ignorant and rude. Now, her remedy to this is to send inspectors around the markets to make sure everybody behaves politely and to broadcast uplifting poetry and stories from the life of the Prophet Muhammad on loudspeakers as a way of, you know, raising the general tone.
And how have the fruit sellers reacted to that?
They don't like it at all. They say they feel insulted and they're being stereotyped as, you know, ignorant, rude people. They've told reporters that there are actually plenty of women working down the markets who have college degrees, but this is the only work they can find. You know, times are hard in the country. Maybe if the government was that interested in women's rights, they say it should do something about improving conditions in the villages where these women work, rather than bothering about spirituality. It's caused a real row on social media as well. And this is interesting because in Uzbekistan, they've been gradually liberalising the political culture in the country and there's more freedom of speech. But this seems to have been a step too far because the Women's Committee, rather than coming back and apologising, has sort of doubled down and said the bloggers and people on Twitter need to watch their step because criticism is one thing, but making fun of the authorities is another.
A little bit closer to the home, in the Netherlands, people are having problems with hungry, hairy caterpillars attacking their oak trees.
Well, that's right. And it's not actually not just the Netherlands. This is an invasive species called the oak processionally caterpillar. It's quite common in southern Europe, but it's moving further north now. And neighbouring countries have been bothered by it too. It's been turning up in London as well. Now, in Holland, it's a bigger problem because the caterpillars have trebled in numbers. We're talking about hundreds of millions of them. This is probably because of the mild winter and spring. Now, gardeners and park keepers are very worried about this because the caterpillar eats the young leaves on the oak tree. So, you know, there's going to be a real problem with the oaks dying out. And they want to get rid of them as quickly and efficiently as possible. Some people have been using vacuum cleaners to suck them up. Others have used flamethrowers. And there's one lady has gone viral on YouTube with a video of her killing them with a heat gun, the sort of thing you use to, you know, dry paint on a fence.
Ooh, I'm guessing conservationists won't like that.
Not at all, no. They say, first of all, their concern is about human safety. If you fire a heat gun or try to vacuum these caterpillars, the hairs on them, hence hairy caterpillar, these hairs are poisonous. They can fly around. They can get stuck in your eyes because they've got hooks and you have to go to hospital to get them out. It's, you know, it's quite a big deal. Now, what conservationists say is that the public should leave getting rid of them to the professionals. And if they have to do something themselves, the thing to do is to plant the sort of flowers that attract the sort of birds that eat these caterpillars. Now, this may seem a slow process, but, you know, the caterpillars will eventually turn into moths and, you know, then your problem's solved.
At least until next year. And that was Martin Morgan from BBC Monitoring. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Joe Lynham, and until next time, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Kevin Fong, and I want to tell you about a special live season finale of 13 Minutes to the Moon, which we're releasing on the 20th of July, exactly 50 years since a human first set foot on the moon. In 1962, President John F. Kennedy made a famous speech at Rice University in Houston, Texas.
We chose to go to the moon.
And it's to Rice University that we're going for our season finale, recorded live in front of an audience. I'll be joined by three Apollo veterans who have been crucial to the podcast. Flight controller John Aaron, flight director Jerry Griffin, and Apollo 7 astronaut Walt Cunningham, as well as an astronaut of a later generation, Peggy Whitson, the first female commander of the International Space Station. They'll be telling us how the moon landing felt for them and talking about the prospect of humans going there again. That's 13 Minutes to the Moon from the BBC World Service. And if you still haven't heard the dramatic story of the Apollo moon landings told by the people who made it happen, search for 13 Minutes to the Moon and start at episode 1.